come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Dr. Felipe Ortego y Gasca. He is a Chicano poet, a Chicano scholar, and one of the very first, if not actually the first, to ever offer a course in Chicano literature. And you cannot speak of the history of Chicano literature itself, without his name not popping up. He is now pushing 90 years old. I think he's 89, and he is still as active as ever. He's writing. He recently did a poetry reading and a talk here in El Paso. This guy is just not going to slow down, and he knows a lot, not only about poetry, but he's even actually been in the movies, which is an interesting fact we'll talk about. So stick around for this interview. And also at the end of the show, I am going to give you a top 10 list of books you should read before you die, according to me. Recently, BorderZine.com asked me, when they did an article on Words on a Wire, to provide a list of the 10 books I think everyone should read before they die. I tried to talk them into changing it to 10 books you should read while you're still alive, because that's really when you should enjoy the books, not after you're dead. But it's nonetheless 10 books you should read before you die, and I'm going to share those books with you after the interview with Ortego y Gasca. So stick around for that. I was reading his biography. There's a lot of sources out there. If you Google his name, you'll find multiple pages on him. He's a very revered scholar and writer. And as I was reading his biography, I kind of reflected on my own. I think we tend to do that. We read the lives of others, and we kind of sometimes think of our own lives, the details of our own lives that made us who we are or who we are becoming, which is probably a better way of saying it, who we are becoming, because hopefully we are still becoming and we haven't arrived and become a parody of ourselves after a while. But in thinking about how I started to become who I am becoming, I realized I had a very privileged background. I'm a Chicano, a working class, but I still am extremely privileged. And I think the reason why is I went to a high school in North Fresno called Hoover. And at this time, and it probably still is, Hoover High was one of the richest schools in Fresno. It was in this incredibly white and upper middle class enclave in the north side of town. But we lived in this little tiny working class neighborhood, a pocket of working class people, an anomaly in the north side of Fresno at the time. It was surrounded by cow pastures and fig orchards, and it was like maybe three or four blocks of tiny working class homes. And I grew up in that neighborhood, and it was Mexican, black, and white, all of us working class. Very few of the children from those houses went to college. But we happened to be in the school district that brought us to Hoover High, which was a very, as I said, upper middle class and white. And the education there was excellent. The teachers really cared. And when you showed a spark of talent or a spark of interest, they loved it and they encouraged it. And I was writing plays and knew I wanted to be a writer by the time I was a junior in high school. And I was constantly encouraged by my teachers. And I realized that that's, you know, not everybody has that. And I think that I am partially a writer today and or a radio host as well, because of that great school. And I'm recalling when Tim Hernandez interviewed Elijah Burrell, he was talking about running into that kid who was discouraged by his teacher for an accent. And it really makes me feel, dang, I am privileged. My teachers cared. And for that reason, I love to teach and I love teachers. And reading his biography makes me think about how I discovered Chicano literature. I was an undergraduate at Fresno State, and I wanted to be a writer. And I also became involved in politics, and I learned that I was a Chicano. In fact, I had never called myself a Chicano before that time. Because I was a Chicano, people were saying, hey, have you read Gary Soto? Hey, have you read Tomas Rivera? Hey, have you read Omar Salinas? And of course, I hadn't, so I started to read them. And now, I think Chicano literature is really my thing. In fact, if you ever hear me referred to, they will probably say the Chicano writer, Daniel Chacon. I am a Chicano writer, and Tim Z. Hernandez is a Chicano writer, and Benjamin Alita Sainz is a Chicano writer. And in part, we have Dr. Ortego y Gasca to thank for that. So stick around for this interview. Dr. Felipe de Ortego y Gasca is the principal scholar of the Chicano Renaissance and is considered founder of Chicano literary history. His essay on the Chicano Renaissance is a landmark text in Chicano literary movement. He studied at the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Texas, and the University of New Mexico, where he received his Ph.D. in English, and it was there that he discovered Chicano literature. Another thing you want to keep in mind is he was the very first director of Chicano Studies here at the University of Texas, El Paso, many years ago. And now he's professor emeritus at Western New Mexico University, which is located in Silver City. It's a beautiful, beautiful campus, a beautiful town. Dr. Ortego y Gasca, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Now, I understand that you're talking to us from Silver City, New Mexico. You're sitting in your office right now at the university, and you're looking out the window. And I
have a huge window with a willow tree out in front that some of the leaves hang down over my window, and I'm looking out at the mountains that surround Silver City. You know, we're right on the edge of the Gila Wilderness, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah. It must be beautiful. Well, actually, I'd say it must be beautiful, but I know I've been there a couple of times, and it really is an incredibly picturesque landscape.
Yeah. I'll tell you, though, however picturesque it is, I sure would like to be at El Paso, though.
Oh, and we'd love to have you here. Yeah, El Paso has its own charm, its own beauty, but you are credited, at least historically, with teaching the very first Mexican-American / Chicano literature course, which you did at University of New Mexico, I don't know how many years.
In 1969.
And your chair, was it your chair, the chair of your department came up to you and said, look, Felipe, can you teach a class on Mexican-American literature? Can you tell us that story?
Well, let's see. In 1969, I was a teaching fellow in the English department at University of New Mexico, finishing up my PhD dissertation in English. And the young man who had been appointed to head up the Chicano Studies program at the University of New Mexico, they were putting together a curriculum for the fall of 1969, and so since I was the only Mexicano in the English department there, they asked if I would organize a course in Mexican-American literature, which I did. And at the time I was finished, I was on my last chapter of a dissertation on Chaucer. I had done a master's thesis on Hamlet, so I was staunchly in the field of British Renaissance studies.
Right, and your master's thesis on Hamlet, that went on to becoming a pretty important book.
It was, and a very provocative book, which brought me a lot of criticism from my English peers.
What was the title again? It was a really provocative title.
The Stamp of One Defect, A Study of Hamlet.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. And why was it so controversial?
Well, it was because I suggested that the problem with Hamlet, the solution to the problem had been going on among the literati for 400 years. And so I deigned to suggest a remedy or to suggest a resolution. And I said that Hamlet's problem was episodic amnesia.
But no, I can understand that. I could see Hamlet as kind of selectively forgetting things in order to get what he desires. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Because Shakespeare, Marlowe, Peel, Green, they all hung around together, and they used to go to a place called Bedlam, which was the hospital at Bethlehem, mm-hmm, in London. And so I think that my impression is that Shakespeare must have seen some character there in the mental ward of that hospital that suggested episodic amnesia. And so he wove it into the character of Hamlet.
And there's a method to the madness. That makes sense.
Uh-huh. Wow. And all the clues that support my contention are all textually in the play.
Nice, nice. So you wrote this book about Hamlet for your thesis, and you were working on your dissertation about Chaucer, and the chair said, "Hey, Felipe."
And the chair said, "Can you organize a course in Mexican American Lit?" I said, "Sure." I mean, it never occurred to me that I didn't know very much about it.
Right, because you were studying the great British writers.
It was easy to organize a course. So I organized the course, and that's when I found out that while there was an extensive history of Mexican-American writers, no one had ever put it together in any kind of taxonomical structure.
How did you find books?
Well, I didn't find books. There were not many books. There were a lot of books that were in libraries, personal libraries, archives and whatnot, but none that were extant in print.
Wow.
So I used a lot of mimeograph material in the days before Xerox.
Oh, yeah, that's when the text actually came out an ink blue.
Exactly.
I remember that.
Exactly. So I've organized a course. I had about 29 students in the course.
Wow. Were they Latino students or were they?
Yeah, they were Latinos in the course. They were in the course to learn something about Mexican-American literature,
right.
And it was the first time that any university had offered such a course.
Wow, so you were the first. That's amazing. What writers did you use? Do you remember?
Oh, well, I taught the writers that had written since 1848.
Oh, wow.
So, Rubén Cobos, for example. There was a New Mexico educator, very famous educator who wrote Forgotten People. And anyway, there were loads. I discovered that there really were hundreds, I mean hundreds of writers writing on different topics, some on cuentos, others on chistes, and some novels that had been written, many in Spanish. But I was surprised that being a Mexican-American in 1969, I had studied English at the University of Pittsburgh as an undergraduate from late 40s, and I had studied at the University of Texas at Austin for my English master's, then taking the doctoral courses at UNM in English. And at no time during those years did it surface that there were Mexican-American writers.
Right, right, yeah.
All I knew were the British writers and the Anglo-American writers.
Yeah, well, you know, I always said Joyce is a Chicano writer, you know, a little alienated from the Great Britain culture and plays with language in innovative ways.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We're talking to Felipe de Ortego y Gasca, a scholar, writer, the very first professor of a Chicano literature class, a Mexican-American literature class. And also we're going to talk a little bit later about your role in Chicano studies at the University of Texas, El Paso, which is also, I think, going to blow away our listeners to find out you were the very first director of Chicano literature here at University of Texas, El Paso. But when you taught that Chicano literature class, did it change you as a scholar and as a writer? Was it transforming?
It was the most transformative moment in my academic life, frankly, Dan. I only had one more chapter to finish on my Chaucer dissertation, and after I taught the course then in January of 1970, I went to the chair of the department, Joe Zavadil, and told him that I wanted to change my dissertation topic to one on Mexican-American literature.
Oh, nice.
Oh, he almost threw me out of his office. And my dissertation committee chair and the members, they thought I was crazy. But I persisted, and sure enough, then I finally got the okay to change my topic from Chaucer, and I wound up writing a dissertation on backgrounds of Mexican-American literature.
Nice.
Which was the first study in the field.
Wow. You also came out in 1975 with one of the very first anthologies of Chicano literature. It was called We Are Chicanos, an anthology of Mexican-American literature.
That was 1973 with Washington Square Press, and that was the first critical anthology of Mexican-American literature published by a major American press.
That's a big publication for Chicano literature back then. Did it do well? How did that?
Oh, it did. I'll tell you what. It did not do very well the first printing. The second printing did a little better. But they only printed 75,000 copies in the first run.
Only?
And 50,000 of those went into remainders.
Wow. Okay, so this question I'm going to ask, to me, is like one of the most important questions I could ever ask somebody with your experience. How has Chicano literature changed over the years from your first anthology or your first class that you taught to today?
It has undergone a transformation of its own, starting from pieces that were pretty much based principally in folklore, cuentos and whatnot. We have moved on to writers like Rudy Anaya up in Albuquerque, mm-hmm. who have really turned out an incredible body of work. I'm hoping that Rudy Anaya, before he expires, that he becomes a nominee and really becomes a Nobel laureate. He is an exceptional writer, and I had the good fortune of knowing him before he wrote Bless the Old Diva.
Yeah.
He was a student. He was finishing up a master's degree in English at UNM when I was there doing doctoral work in English.
He blurred my very first book, Chicano Chicanery, and he didn't even know me, but he just gave it a really, really nice blurb. And and we had him on the show one time when his the movie version of Bless Mi Ultima came
out.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, he's a wonderful man, and certainly, yeah, one of the most important in the history of our literature. What about the young people? Who are the young? And of course, you can go ahead and mention me. That's okay, but other than me.
Under the Feet of Jesus by...
yes, by Elena Maria Viramontes.
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. And her first book, Moths, certainly had a lot of influence on Chicano literature.
Oh, exactly. And then, of course, Denise Chavez, who, from my point of view, is still a young woman.
Absolutely. She certainly acts like a young woman. She's got energy of like, oh, my God, her energy is just contagious. And as somebody who loves Chicano literature so much, who's, you know, who has dedicated so much part of your intellectual and creative energy to, you know, to its preservation and getting its due respect in our literary culture, how does it feel when you find out about places like Tucson School District, where they're trying to or have effectively banned Chicano literature in classrooms?
Well, it's not a good day in America for Americans in general that they would allow that to happen. And MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, is pursuing judicial action on that based on the First Amendment as a freedom of speech.
Yeah, it certainly was ridiculous claims that it was the subversive literature trying to overthrow the government.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are so many young Chicanos out there in Arizona now and elsewhere, as Tony Diaz from Houston, who has organized at Libro Traficante. They are really out there putting their bodies on the line.
Oh, absolutely. He's doing great work. We had him on the show, actually, to talk about that when he was doing the Libro Traficante, going around the country distributing banned books.
And I'm sad to say that since I have some serious mobility issues these days, I'm in a wheelchair or scooter. I really would like to, and I'm still thinking that maybe a wheelchair and all, I would like to get out to Tucson to talk to those young people who are doing tremendous work down out there with the most famous of which I'm reading now, called Raza Studies. And if you don't know that book, I would encourage you to look it up.
I have a little-known fact that I'm going to share with our listeners. You have an IMDb page on the internet, and if our listeners don't know what an IMDb page is, it's anytime you look up an actor or a director or anyone involved in movies or TV, that's one of the first things that come up. They're movie credits and their film credits. You have a page, and it's because you participated in a movie called Dancer Texas, Population 81. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I still get royalties on it.
No way.
97 cents.
Hey, I tried to find it. You can't find it anywhere unless you pay for it. So, yeah, tell us about the movie and what was your participation in it?
Well, that was in 1998 when I was out at Sal Ross in Alpine, Texas. The movie was filmed just north of there at Fort Davis. Mm. And it's essentially about four kids in high school who make a pact that when they graduate, they're going to go out to Los Angeles and build their fortune. And it really is a very good film. I was fortunate to be cast as the high school principal, which was a featured role. But I did a previous film called Nadine with Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger.
Oh yeah, I know that film. I didn't know you were in that.
It was not a very big part, but I was in it. And then I've done some other. I was the narrator for a film that was produced by Greenwood Press in 1971 called North from Texas, based upon Kerry McWilliams' historical book.
No, that's fascinating. And the movie, Dancer Texas Population 81, is still available. You can rent it on iTunes or on Google Play or places like that. I'm going to definitely see that because it seems like a fascinating movie. I want to talk a little bit about your own writing, especially your creative writing. I know you did a chapbook of poetry in 1952. I think that was your first one.
That was, huh?
Yeah.
And that was the year that I finished at Pitt.
And are you still writing poetry? And what are you doing
creatively?
Oh,
yes. In 64, when I was in, I was teaching at Jefferson High School. I taught French there.
In El Paso?
Jeff Jefferson, La Jeff.
La Jeff, really? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was, people would ask me, Ed, why are you teaching these kids French? I mean, they don't know Spanish, they can't speak English. Well, I told my kids that since they were prohibited from speaking Spanish on the school grounds or in the building, that they should speak to each other in French. Yeah, anyway, well, now I've got four manuscripts, two of which look very promising.
Nice.
These are collections of essays that I have written.
Mm-hmm.
I finished one on La Leyenda Negra, the black legend, and that's being looked at by Oxford University Press. And then I finished one called Cannon Fodder, C-A-N-O-N.
And, oh, that's great. I love that title.
And that's a collection of essays. It's a couple hundred pages long.
Wow.
Collection of essays that I've done on the effort to gain for Chicano literature a standing in the American literary canon.
Well, I wish you the best of luck on that, and thank you for joining us. I really enjoyed our conversation with you, and I have deep respect for what you've done for all of us.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you, Felipe. We've been talking to Felipe de Ortego y Gasca. Recently, BorderZine.com asked me to provide a top 10 list of books you should read before you die, although I'm still going to change the language, and I'm going to say 10 books you should read while you're still living. So here it is. Y'all do like David Letterman. Paul and the band, please play. Here it is, top 10 list. Number one, and this isn't in any particular order. I just kind of randomly put them in order. When My Brother Was an Aztec by Natalie Diaz. This is a very recent book of poems, and it's probably one of the best new collections, first collections in a long time. She's, quite frankly, a brilliant poet. And we had her on the show. Tim and I interviewed her recently. You can go into our archives and check out that interview. She talks about When My Brother Was an Aztec. But these poems are amazing. They go absolutely anywhere. Number two, and this might surprise a lot of people, unless you know me, and then you'll understand why it's on the list. Heaven and Its Wonders and Hell by Emanuel Swedenborg. Now, this is a book that is hard to get a hold of, but Swedenborg was a scientist. He was a mathematician, and he was, as his name might indicate, from Sweden. But he went to London a lot, and as he was walking around the streets of London, angels started to talk to him. They started to say, hey, you want to see heaven? And they took him to heaven. They showed it to him. They showed him around, and then they took him down to hell, showed him around there. They explained everything to him. And this book is essentially a tour guide, a travel guide through heaven and hell, and it is not fiction. At least Swedenborg thinks it's not fiction, but he might have been crazy. Who knows? Angels talk to me occasionally. Number three, Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. It is a novel, and it is one of the funniest novels out there. I'm actually using it in my humor class. I read this novel when I was in high school, and it made me want to be a writer. It's a fantastic book, and that Catch-22 certainly has become an idiomatic expression in American English when we say catch-22. It's kind of like a situation that you can't get out of. The classic catch-22 is, well, you can't get a job unless you have experience, but you can't get experience unless you have a job. Number four, The Sneetches by Dr. Seuss. This is one of the very first books I read about racism. It's obviously a metaphor for racism. The Sneetches that have stars on their bellies are the privileged ones in the community. They can eat at the nice places. They can sit in the front of the bus. And the Sneetches without the stars on their bellies, quite frankly, they're the Chicanos and the blacks and the people of color and the working class white people. Number five, The Mouse and the Motorcycle. I read this when I was in grade school, and it is by Beverly Cleary. I haven't read this book since I was a kid, but, well, it has a mouse and it has a motorcycle. What more do you need? Number six, any book by Jorge Luis Borges. He probably is one of the most influential writers in, quite frankly, any language. He's certainly had influenced me in the way I think and the way I see reality. Another one who has influenced me greatly is Toni Morrison. And number seven in the list is Jazz. This is one of the most beautiful novels, lyrically speaking, that I have ever had the privilege to enter into. And when you enter into a landscape like Toni Morrison's Jazz, or any Toni Morrison novel, quite frankly, anything can happen. I wouldn't call it magical realism because I think that kind of reduces or singularizes or makes superficial the whole idea of an alternate reality. But it's a great read. You should read it. Eight, Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid. This is Douglas R. Hofstadter's Pulitzer Prize-winning essay on the similarities between Gödel and his mathematical theorems, Escher and his paintings that defied logic, and Bach and his fugues and his Richterkars. It's just a brilliant book about logic and illogic and how we think. Number nine, A View with a Grain of Sand, which is a collection of the selected poems of Wisława Szymborska, who is one of the greatest poets in the world. But it's a fantastic collection of poems. 10, Flood Song by Sherwin Bitsui. This is another first book. He's a Native American writer out of Arizona, I believe. Ben and I had him on the show a couple of years ago, and you should go back and listen to that. He's just an amazing poet, and I don't know how he arrives in the realities and the images and the music that he arrives in, but it's a brilliant book. Anyway, those are my 10 books you should read while you're still living. And another thing that kind of bothers me about this list is that I can only do 10. I wish they would have asked me for my top 100 books you should read while you are still alive, because there'd certainly be a lot of them on there, including the books of my co-host, Tim Z. Hernandez, his Mañana Means Heaven, and Benjamin Alida Sainz, his Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club. And, well, maybe even one or two of my books should be on that list. Or maybe not. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me on Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank my guest, Felipe Ortego y Gasca, and our producer, Norma Martinez. Don't forget, the next book you read, you should read while you're still alive.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.